The title of today's sermon is Motherly Love. Now, brethren, we know very well that Jesus Christ, He loved and He honored His mother Mary. We can see that in many ways, especially as we read the biblical accounts of the life of Jesus Christ. The Bible records a number of interactions between Jesus and Mary in which Jesus Christ properly honors His mother. And another way that we can know that Jesus honored His mother is because Jesus Christ never sinned. And one of the commandments is to honor your father and your mother. And Jesus never sinned by breaking any of the commandments. And I'll just give you this first commandment about honoring father and mother from Deuteronomy 5 and verse 16. This is a reiteration of the giving of the commandments just before the children of Israel went into the promised land. It says in Deuteronomy 5 and verse 16, honor your father and your mother as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be prolonged and that it may go well with you, that it may go well with you in the land which the Lord your God gives unto you. So, brethren, let's talk a little bit about motherly love and honoring mothers. And I want you to understand that this commandment to honor our mothers is not just for little children. I suppose that I spent most of my life thinking that was the commandment for children. Children, honor your parents. And you think of little kids and how they need to be taught respect, need to be taught honor, they need to be taught obedience. But this commandment is for all men. Little children can't sin. Oh, they might offend, and they do need to be trained up in the way they should go. But this commandment, honor your parents, is for grown-ups. Now, let's make no mistake about that. And I think it behooves us when we read, honor your father and honor your mother, that we take it to heart. And since it's a commandment, it is a salvational issue. Now, I noticed that Mother's Day was coming up, and I thought it would be appropriate to present in a sermon the biblical perspective on motherly love. I imagine we all have concepts about motherly love, but I wanted to, for my sake and for your sake, take a look at what the Bible has to say about it. Now, brethren, you very well know that each week I send out the countdown to the return of Jesus Christ, and I send it out to hundreds of people with a brief synopsis of what I plan to give the sermon on. I sent the countdown out late on Friday night, and I always do that, try to always do that, so that people will have it the first thing when they get up on Sabbath morning. I was a little surprised this morning to receive two negative responses from people who said that they believe Mother's Day to be pagan, and therefore they do not recognize it. And brethren, you understand, we're trying to teach from the Scriptures. We're trying to teach as we have been taught. One thing we try to do is we try to be very careful not to trample on someone's faith. Now, that's important. But at the same time, we have the responsibility to prove all things from the Bible. Now, I thought, wouldn't it be nice if in addition to Mother's Day, and then a little later in the year, Father's Day, wouldn't it be nice if we had a national holiday set aside for every one of God's Ten Commandments? And I remember back when we were all in the Worldwide Church of God, and we were at Pasadena, California, when we presented each mother, as they came into the auditorium, we presented them with a long-stemmed rose as they came to Sabbath services on the Mother's Day weekend. It was nice, and it was appropriate. Mother's Day is a fine way to recognize mothers. It's a good reminder of how we should each honor our mother every day of the year, each and every day of the year. Now, after receiving the two emails declaring that Mother's Day is pagan, I went to one of the internet links that was provided in one of the emails, and I was surprised to find that this Mother's Day, this weekend in 2009 is 100 years since the formation of Mother's Day in this country. It doesn't go back centuries and centuries. It's a rather new celebration or holiday in America. And here's how it came about. In 1907, that's a little over, it's about 102 years ago, a lady back east by the name of Anna Jarvis, she sought to create a national day to honor mothers. You know, we have days for like Labor Day and Memorial Day, and she wanted a day for mothers. The country had gone through a number of wars, and mothers had served in different ways, sometimes in Red Cross kind of duties and hospital service, and she thought that the mothers should be recognized. And so in 1907, Anna Jarvis launched a campaign for a national day to honor mothers by handing out white carnations to the people going to church at her mother's church in West Virginia. And then the next year, 1908, she did the same thing in honor of mothers. But it was starting to catch on, and it spread across the country. It spread to other churches in 46 states, which is pretty good coverage. And so Anna Jarvis decided herself to become a full-time letter writer in a letter-writing campaign, imploring politicians and clergymen and civic leaders to institute a national day for mothers. And a few years later, in 1912, less than 100 years ago, Jarvis's effort met with success. Her home state of West Virginia adopted an official Mother's Day. A National Mother's Day became official 2 years later when the U.S. Congress passed a joint resolution signed by President Wilson establishing a National Mother's Day, emphasizing the role of women in their families. Now, I thought that was entirely appropriate, the thinking behind it and the way that it came up. Ever since then, Mother's Day has been celebrated by Americans on the second Sunday in May. Now, brethren, personally, to me, the celebration of Mother's Day seems to be founded on a godly principle. Honor your mother, as the commandment says. But doing a little more research, I did find that a number of ancient cultures paid tribute to mothers as goddesses, and that included the ancient Greeks and the Romans. But just for the record, that is not what we advocate. What we do advocate is honoring our mother each and every day of the year. And perhaps one National Day of Mother's Day will help remind us of our continuous obligation to honor our mothers. And so let's be careful not to become overly righteous, substituting our righteousness for God's righteousness. It's a false religion. It's a form of false worship to say, well, I don't do Mother's Day, you know, raising yourself to some kind of level. All we do in God's church, now I'm sure there are people that do it incorrectly, all we do is remind ourselves, remind our mothers how much we love them and honor them, and it should impart to us the thought, the obligation, that we should be doing that every day of the year. Honoring mothers is a right thing to do. Let's go to John chapter 2. Look, brethren, the pagans, they ate breakfast, they got married, they wore wedding rings, they had mothers. Can you and I distinguish the righteousness of Jesus Christ from godless paganism? I think that we can. And let me say right here, brethren, a Mother's Day card, a single email, or a phone call once a year does not fulfill the intent of the biblical command, the command of God to honor our mothers. Just one hello, one card a year is far from honoring. It comes very far from fulfilling the commandment to honor our mothers. John chapter 2 and verse 1. Let's look at an example. Let's look at an example in the life of Jesus Christ, where it shows us a little bit about the relationship between Jesus Christ and his mother. And let me point out, before we even start here in John 2 and verse 1, that Jesus Christ is a grown man, a mature man, 30 years of age, you know, a businessman, a carpenter, a construction man, embarking on the 3.5 years of his public ministry when this takes place. In fact, it begins, and the third day, this is when Jesus began to gather together the men that would be his apostles later on. And the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And we want to watch closely because we want to know, how do we honor our mothers? How do we honor our parents? We don't want to do like the world or the pagans. We want to do it God's way. Verse 2. And both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. So Jesus and the disciples that he had chosen were invited. Come to the marriage. Seems like, you know, a bunch of relatives are going to be there and a bunch of friends. Verse 3. And when they wanted wine, they ran out of wine. Maybe you've been to a wedding where they had a case of champagne, and the champagne flowed freely, and about the time you really needed to have a toast to the bride and groom, you were out of champagne. Well, something like that happened. Verse 3, continuing, Mary, this is the mother of Jesus, said unto him, four words, they have no wine. Now, brethren, that's a very short conversation between mother and son. They have no wine. Yet, I believe if we take a look at what's going on here, we'll see that there's much more than meets the eyes. Now, the King James translators do not capture the tenderness of this moment. Verse 4 says, Jesus said unto her, woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. That is a terrible, terrible translation. It almost looks like, sounds like Jesus is talking down to his mother, holding her in dishonor and disrespect. And I submit to you, brethren, it's a terrible translation. Let's see what we can do with it. The word for woman here is G-U-N-E in the Greek, gune. And it refers, this word gune refers specifically to a woman who is a wife. You wouldn't say gune to a teenage girl who's unmarried. It's more like our Mrs., M-R-S, period. So a better translation of this verse would be, Jesus calls his mother, refers to her as gune. But it should be translated like this. John 2 and verse 4. Jesus said, yes, ma'am, what is it that you desire me to do? My hour is not yet come. Jesus said it very lovingly, respectfully, and in honor to his mother. That is the way that he said it. Now, what's not said here in the scriptures is manifold. When Jesus respectfully says to his mother that it was not time to start working some big miracles prior to the start of his 3.5 year ministry, it sounds like Jesus is saying it's not time to start doing these big public miracles like this, mom, you know, and he voices that concern. In fact, Jesus was just beginning to get his apostles lined up. And you can go back into John chapter 1, the previous chapter, and see this. Now, brethren, here is where you and I have to allow God's Holy Spirit to open our understanding as to what is going on between the lines here. What's going on behind the scenes? Jesus is 30 years old. He's not some little kid. He's not even a young man. He's a grown man. And Mary simply says to Jesus, they have no wine. And she fully knows that Jesus is going to take care of the matter. Now that tells you what their ongoing relationship was like. When Jesus heard his mother's request, when he heard her plea, when he saw her need, Jesus Christ, being the perfect son that he was, sinless son, responded in a godly way to his mother's desires. Now, maybe Mary didn't know how Jesus would take care of the lack of wine, but she had no doubt in her mind that it was going to be taken care of. Verse 5. Notice, Mary doesn't even respond to Jesus. It's not recorded that she does about it's not time to start doing these miracles. She says in verse 5, his mother, this is Mary, she says to the servants, whatsoever he says unto you, do it. So we can see that Mary is somewhat, maybe she's the host at this wedding, or maybe she's helping out a friend, but she has some authority, some responsibility here. She goes to the servants and says, you know, you do whatever Jesus tells you to do. And there were set there 6 water pots of stone after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing 2 to 3 firkins apiece. In verse 7, Jesus says unto them, fill the water pots with water. They knew it was water. They're the ones that put the water in there. And they filled them up to the brim. Verse 8. And then he said unto them, draw out now and bear unto the governor of the feast. And they bear. So what they did, just no sooner than the jugs were filled all the way to the top. I picture these things being, you know, 3 or 4 feet tall, great big old jugs, about as much as men could manhandle. They just got them there, and there's still ripples on the top. He says, dip in there and bring some to the chief host, the man in charge, or whoever the governor is of the feast. Verse 9, and when the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine and knew not whence it was, he didn't know where it came from. Somebody just brought him some wine and said, taste this. You know, wine tasting is always a big thing. You know, is this really good wine, or is it sour before you pass it around and everything? But in the parenthetical inset, it says here, but the servants which drew the water, they knew that this was out of the water jugs. The governor of the feast called the bridegroom. Here's a man that's getting married. Okay, he has a very big place in the wedding, doesn't he? Verse 10, and he says unto him, every man at the beginning doth set forth the good wine. You know, you put the good bottles out while everybody is kind of measuring up the get-together, like, you know, are we going to have some of that sour stuff like we had over at Joe Blow's place, or is there going to be some good wine here? And he put the good stuff out first when everybody's kind of tasting it, making a judgment call. And continuing in verse 10, and when men have drank a whole lot, then that which is worse, you know, you save the poor wine for last when, you know, palates are not quite as discriminating. But you have kept the good wine until now. This is really good stuff. So, you know, we wouldn't expect Jesus to make anything less. Verse 11. This beginning of miracles. So the Bible declares that this water into wine is a miracle of Jesus Christ. This beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee and manifested forth his glory. And that brings a lot of attention to you when you do something like that. It manifested his glory. It showed his power. It showed his wisdom. It showed his miraculous intervention. And his disciples believed on him. Now, brethren, the Bible clearly states that Jesus was of a mind that it was not yet time for him to start doing miracles, for his glory to be manifested forth. Why did Jesus work miracles before he was ready to work miracles? Why did Jesus change his mind and then work a miracle before it was time? And the answer is because of the commandment to honor his mother. Jesus honored his mother. God the Father works to make all things fall into place. As Paul put it in Romans 8:28, you know, all things work together for the good for those of us who are being called and so forth. Jesus understood that his mother came to him for assistance in time of need with a request. She needed help. And he was obligated to honor her. Now, here's something that we in God's church need to grow and understand and mature in. You know, everybody wants a Talmud, thou shalt not, you know, page after page, so we know just how far we can go. What takes place right here between the lines in John chapter 2 cannot be put down in the Talmud. It takes faith. It takes understanding. It takes godly wisdom. That obligation to Jesus' mother, Jesus' obligation to his mother, superseded the timing of the miracles that would indicate to the world that Jesus was the Messiah. Now you'd say, wow, no, miracles, that's the biggest thing, that's the greatest thing ever, those miracles, that's really something. And Jesus said, it's not time to do miracles. And his mother comes to Jesus and says, they have no wine. And brethren, that superseded what Jesus was planning to do as far as the miracles were. God the Father says, honor your mother. Jesus honored his mother. So he set aside his own time schedule, his own plans about putting off miracles to later, and he worked a miracle there, honoring his mother. And I just have you study Isaiah 61, and you'll see the purpose of miracles. The purpose of miracles was to show that Jesus Christ was the Messiah, to show that it was the acceptable year of the Lord. That's why Jesus was waiting till a set date to begin the miracles that the world would see. You're going to see that the purpose of Jesus' miracles was to show that he was the Messiah. That's why Jesus, you know, healed the blind and the lame and those with the palsy and raised the dead and so forth. And, you know, you can put this in your notes. We see that in Matthew 11. This is just a side. You don't have to turn there. I'll read it to you. Matthew 11 and verse 4. This is when John the Baptist was thrown in prison. And John wondered if Jesus was the Messiah. Is he really the Messiah? And John's about to be beheaded. And Jesus answered and said to the disciples of John the Baptist, go and show John again those things which you do see and hear. The blind receive their sight. That's a sign of the Messiah. The lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, the poor have the gospel preached to them. That was the purpose of the miracles, and Jesus wasn't ready to start doing that. But for the honor toward his mother, for that sake, Jesus went ahead and he turned water into wine. Turning water into wine a little early did not obstruct the main purpose of the prophesied miracles. But it was a special sign to the disciples, who would later become the apostles. Jesus, as we read back there in verse 11, Jesus manifests forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him. Turned out to be a sign for the disciples, not so much to the world. And it came about through God the Father's intervention through Mary, God the Father knowing that Jesus Christ would honor his mother in all things, Jesus worked the miracle. Brethren, all 10 of the 10 commandments are necessary for salvation. I received another email today from another man asking me about Sabbath keeping, and he wanted to know if it was a salvation issue to keep the Sabbath. The answer is yes. The keeping of the commandments is a salvational issue. The keeping of 9 commandments is never good enough. You know, just like you can't skip the Sabbath command, you cannot omit the commandment about honoring your parents. Indeed, for some, honoring your parents just might be a test commandment. I'd like to tell you the story of a man that came into the church quite some few years ago. I was pastoring some congregations over in the Carolinas, and I received a call from a man one evening. And this man called, as people often did in those days, in response either to a publication or an advertisement or something on TV somewhere. And it was relayed to me. He was given my phone number, and he called me. And I was the first one to deal with him on a person-to-person basis. And in talking to him, I found out a whole lot about him. He was an older man. God calls older people. It's not rare, but it's not the norm. This man was in his late 50s. And he informed me that he wanted to move toward baptism. He wanted to become a converted Christian. And he had been reading some literature, but this was his first contact with a minister. And we talked about his life and how it was that he came to be called. and a lot of details about his life. His father had died, and I found out that he had a lot of brothers and sisters. And during the course of the conversation, when I asked him if his mother was still alive, his response surprised me. He said, "I don't know. I don't know if she's alive or not." And I thought, did I hear this right? So I clarified his remark with, "You don't know if your mother is alive or not?" And he said, no. He says, "I'm ashamed to say, but I haven't spoken to her in 11 years. And I asked him, "Why? Why not? Why haven't you spoken to your mother?" And he explained to me that, you know, when he was younger, he had wanted her to be proud of him. But as his life had unfolded and, you know, things came and went, his life had not turned out as he originally hoped. It didn't turn out so good. And he just didn't know how he could face his mother again. And so, little by little, he just lost touch with her, and all of those years slid by. And so we moved on to some other subjects for a while, talked a little bit about church history, talked a little bit about doctrine. And when it was about time for the conversation to conclude, he asked me what he should work on so that he could move towards baptism. He says, "I want to be baptized. What should I do?" And I said, "You need to find out if your mother is dead or alive. And if she's alive, you need to go and see her." And he went, "Man, go and see her? Man, I thought you were going to say that all I needed to do was pray and fast or studies, something like that. That's what I thought you were going to ask me to do. But go see my mama? Oh, man." Oh. And he said it as though I was asking the impossible. And I said, "Look, God only has 10 commandments, but one of them says you got to go see your mama." And brethren, for 2 years, I didn't hear a word back from that man again. In fact, in the meantime, the church went through one of its many and frequent divisions, and I moved back to Arkansas. And one Friday evening, the Sabbath was just about to begin, he called and he identified himself and he said, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "How's your mama?" And he went, "Man, how do you remember that? Oh, man. Yeah, my mama's fine. We're good. We're very good." In fact, brethren, it was a great blessing for him to be reconciled to his mother. It was great for him, good for him, and it was great for her. Because mothers have great feelings in their hearts. And so we went ahead and counseled a number of more times. And when he was ready, I drove back to North Carolina and I picked up a deacon along the way. And we went out to his home and we baptized him out in North Carolina. And he kept the Sabbath. And he kept all the feasts of God. Came to the feast 1 year with us. Even in Gatlinburg. He kept the feast until years later he died. Still very dedicated, and he died in the faith. "Honor your mother" was the test commandment for him. And he passed the test with flying colors. Let me share another story from the distant past about a man and his mother. This one took place in Pasadena, California. 2 decades ago, let's say. We had a Hispanic man in the congregation, and he had a grossly deformed shoulder as a result of childhood abuse. Somebody had grabbed him by the arm, lifted him, pulled his arm out of socket, and in those days, his conditions, his economic status and so forth, it wasn't put back in the socket. It wasn't repaired. And he grew up his whole life. And I know you've all seen John McCain, you know, in his torture injuries, you know, how he can't raise his elbows any higher than shoulder level. This man's one shoulder on one side was in much worse shape than that, but he did have one good arm. But it was a result of some childhood abuse that was never repaired. But this man had a beautiful, wonderful gift. He had a gift of summing up a sermon in a very few poetic lines. In fact, you know, one of the ministers could give a 10-page sermon that he could summarize better in 10 lines of his poetry. And I have many of his poems. I kept them all of these years. And I believe that this one poem is appropriate here. The man's name was Art Martinez. He was born in 1928. So this goes way back. And he died in 1990. He was a longtime Church of God member, and he resided in Pasadena, California. And he wrote this particular poem in honor of his gray-haired mother and ours. And the poem is entitled, "Mom, You're the Greatest. To raise me cost you your best years. Your mother love allayed my fears. Your comfort helped to dry my tears. Mom, you're the greatest. You've always had a heart of gold. Your love for me is wealth untold. When they made you, they broke the mold. Mom, you're the most. I know that I cannot repay the many times you spent the day beside my sickbed where I lay. Mom, you're the greatest. A crown of silver strands you wear. A life of giving, put it there. Of giving tender, loving care. Mom, you're the best. For motherhood, you paid the price. How great then was your sacrifice. A simple thank you will not suffice, because Mom, you're the greatest." Now, brother, I want to shift gears here just a little bit. Not every one of us has a good mother. Many of us didn't have Christian mothers. Some of us have had mothers that are incorrigible. That's the way of this world. What do you do then? Where do good mothers come from? How do they originate? No mother was born a mother. They were born little infant girls. They grew up as little girls. When did she become a mother? And I'm not talking about giving birth. I'm talking about acquiring the attributes that define who and what a good mother is. Where do mothers come from? It's not natural. It does not automatically take place. We cannot expect that every young lady grows into maturity, has children, and becomes a good mother. There are few really good mothers. It starts off when a child is born. First, she was a little girl. And as a little girl, she had all the fears and doubts and concerns and questions that all little girls have. She was not yet ready to be a mother. How does a little girl in a ponytail or pigtails become a good mother with motherly love? When does she become soft and tender? When does she become understanding and gracious? When did she learn patience? And when did she learn the right words to say at the right time? When did she finally have all the answers to all the questions that her children were going to put forth? When she began to grow and the demands upon her exceeded her ability to perform to everyone else's demands, how did she eventually find balance in her life? Like every young lady growing up, when she got to high school, boys became interesting. even it's exciting. And she dreamed. Maybe one boy would carry her away to the land of her dreams and bring her love and security and take her away from all of her problems and worries. In asking the question, when did she become a mother? I'm talking about, when did she learn to worry when you were ill? When did she learn to care when you were having a problem at school? When did she realize that she was willing to die so that you could live? When did you become so much a part of her that without you, she would not be whole? Mothers seem to know. They seem to know the answers to these things. Little young ladies in school do not know. Not yet. When do they learn to say the right thing at the right moment? When do they learn to solve every difficulty? Turn over to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Paul tells us how young ladies should be modest and pure and chaste, giving their faithfulness to only one man in this lifetime. That's the way God designed it. Oh, perhaps if a husband dies in an accident or at war or something, she might remarry. But that's not the plan. The plan is for one young lady and one young man to marry for life. That's the way that God designed it. Paul uses a phrase to describe faithfulness to your marriage covenant. He uses the phrase, possess your vessel. He's talking about keeping yourself holy, pure, and chaste for the one that you're going to share your life with. A young person should be faithful to their life's mate from the time they're born, not just in marriage, but before marriage, during marriage, and after marriage. That's what it means to possess your vessel. You have something that you share with only one person on earth. It's a godly gift, and it's to be given once and only once. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 4, in verse 4, that every one of you should know how to possess your vessel in sanctification and honor. It's something very sacred, something very special. Now, brethren, where does a young girl learn to be a mother? That lesson is not learned on the playground or at school, but it is learned from a good mother. It's learned from a Christian mother. And if you are so blessed, it's learned from a godly grandmother. Paul urged the older women, like the grandmothers, to teach the younger women to be good mothers and to love their children. You can read about that in Titus chapter 2 and verse 4. That's where a mother first learns that she must possess her vessel in a way that she becomes available and useful to God to help in the process of bringing many sons and daughters to glory. Not just raising up her daughters to be good mothers, but in the eternal scheme of things, to be good Christians. Being a right example of motherhood to her children. And we didn't all receive that. Some of us were dealt something less. But that works out in the plan of God. And it can work out to God's greater honor and glory. When a little girl does not have a good mother, it's very difficult for her to grow up to be a good mother. But it can be done. It takes God's direction. It takes God's intervention. It takes God's work to change and to heal and to make whole. You know, young mothers, especially in this day and time, they carry baggage. They carry baggage that was dumped on them. Sometimes, unfortunately, they carry their own baggage, and they're still dealing with closure on the problems and the sins of youth, just like everybody else. You know, King David was no different. Put this one in your notes. We've touched on it many times, even at Passover. Psalm 51 and verse 5, David speaks about his youthfulness was not perfect. He was subject to the results and the effects of sin. He says, "Behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." And so then a little later in Psalm 51:10, he asked God, "Create in me a clean heart, O God. Renew a right spirit within me." Brethren, it can be done. If we've been dealt a bad hand, if our mothers weren't in the church, if our mothers were cruel and abusive and ungodly, we can still pour out our hearts to God, explain our situation to Him, and ask Him to cleanse us and to create a clean heart in us. But young mothers do have hurts and pains and disappointments. And even worse than that, some have been betrayed horribly, abused, and lied to. How do they effectively produce closure on whatever has occurred in their past so that they too can begin the next generation with a pretty clean slate without the baggage that life has dealt them? It takes spiritual healing. That's the answer. And the answer is available to us. God can help us put that behind us. God can help us to overcome. Oh, there might be scars that will remain your whole life. Women are made to be able to carry a great propensity for pain and suffering and tuck it away in their hearts. It takes God's direct intervention. It is only God who can wash us clean so that we can function, so that we can grow, so that we can become the children of God. God has put it within mothers. He has made it a part of mothers to have the ability to carry so much in their hearts. Picture this, John 19 and verse 25. In John 19 and verse 25, Jesus Christ is dying. He's on the stake. His hands are pierced. His feet are pierced. His skin is stripped from his body. And we're told by John in verse 25, there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother. And there were some others. One of his aunts was there and so forth. Can you imagine the love of a mother, Mary, who loved her son with a dear love and a great love, seeing her son dying? She had to carry that in her heart. It says in Luke 2:19 that all of her adult life, Mary kept all these things and pondered them in her heart. Luke 2:19. That was from the day that it was announced that she would be the mother of God, the mother of the Messiah. She carried that in her heart. What a tremendous heart. What a tremendous thing to be able to carry the hopes, the hurts, the pains, the dreams. Mothers are like that. They're made to carry those things in their heart. Young mothers can grow up and they can have inordinate fears, fears that shouldn't be there, but fears nonetheless. It is the mother who instills so much into the children. Yes, both mom and dad are needed. That's God's way. The dad is needed in the lives of the children, and the mother is needed in the lives of the children. But it is the mother who instills so much. The mother brings the soft side. She brings the tender aspects, the gentle ways. It is the mother who shows the child the more excellent way. It is the mother who cries when the child goes off to school. Ephesians chapter 6. When we read the Bible carefully, we see a number of family connections and interactions that help us better understand their importance to us. Those things are written, brethren, for us, for our admonition, for our growth, for our edification. Ephesians 6 and verse 1. Paul is writing to the Ephesians, and as a teacher, he refers to the members of the congregation and to some extent the younger people in the congregation in chapter 6 and verse 1. "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." We've all been children. Then he says in verse 2, "Honor your father and your mother," which is the first commandment with promise. That's the promise of long life of remaining in a land, remaining in a nation for a long time without the enemy thrusting you out. Verse 3, that it may be well with you. You honor your parents, brethren, so that it'll be well with you, and you may live long on the earth. So he changes it to the whole earth as we get to the New Testament. And brethren, we can see that taking place even in our country today. There is no honor of mothers. Sure, there's a national day, but there's no real honor for the godly concepts, precepts, statutes that a mother can pass down to her children. In this godless society, this world does not honor their parents. And in so doing, or being remiss to honor their parents, we will be cast out of this land. Israel went into captivity for breaking the commandments. One of them had to do with honoring their parents. They did not stay long in the land. And brethren, I submit to you, we're not going to stay long on this land either. John chapter 19. Jesus Christ, in one of his very last acts on earth, paid final honor to his mother Mary. He assured his mother's care in her last years to the beloved disciple John the Apostle. Now, Jesus was going to die. He was going to be resurrected. He was going to be at the right hand of God. Certainly, Jesus could have simply taken care of his mother's need from his heavenly throne, right? Yes, but he doesn't work that way. God expects hands-on action from each and every one of us on earth in honoring our mothers. It's not a sentiment. It's a reality. Christ's honor for his mother is recorded for us, upon whom the ends of the world has come. John 19 and verse 26. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple standing by whom he loved, that's John, he said unto his mother, woman, behold thy son. Very respectful. Great deal of honor. He says, I am gone. Now, Jesus had other brothers. At least four more, the Bible records. Jesus didn't leave his mother to them. He had no converted brothers. They weren't called yet. That's up to God the Father whether the brothers of Jesus Christ would be called. And we know that some of them were. John was already baptized. John was one of the apostles. Jesus saw fit to leave his mother in John's care. Then he said to the disciple, verse 27, behold your mother. This was a very official act. He was transferring his responsibility. Jesus was transferring his responsibility to the apostle John. You've got the care of my mother. You've got to honor her, take care of her, look out for her needs, everything a son does for his mother. And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own home. She became his mother. Jesus never ceased to his last breath, to his last drop of blood, in honoring his mother. You know, brethren, we live in a horrible world where our children are being taught at school and on TV and movies and from their friends and on the playground that marriage and motherhood are undesirable. Skip that. They're taught that homosexuality and lesbianism are the norm. They're more preferable lifestyles. Brethren, mothers are needed. Church mothers, godly mothers are needed. That's why good marriages are the foundation of society. You leave a bunch of perverted people have their way for a generation or two, and the country will cease to exist. No one will be in the land. There won't be enough of a population, and society will fail. You know, social workers are taught that's a bunch of nonsense, that you don't need a mother and a father. You know, any parent can do it. Brethren, that is not God's way. God teaches us that we're supposed to have a nuclear family with a father and with a mother. You turn over to Genesis chapter 2. Do you realize there are 14 million single-parent households in the United States? And the great majority of them suffer from poverty and disease, and the children grow up, and this is the worst thing, the lack of motherly instruction. Even the single mothers who raise their children, they are not able to teach their children the right social, behavioral aspects of being good children, you know, to love, to keep the commandments and so forth. It's gone. It's totally missing. And children in that environment grow up with emotional scars. They're going to pass them on to their children as well. There's a term, nuclear family, and it refers to a household consisting of a father and a mother with their children, and they live in a house. It's not, you know, like four generations of aunts and uncles and grandmothers and grandfathers and everybody all living together. God is the one who instituted the nuclear family at creation. And he said that here in Genesis 2 and verse 4. He says, therefore shall a man leave his father. You know, not, you don't stay in the same house with your daddy and your mom and your grandpa and your uncles and everybody. He shall leave his father and his mother, and he shall cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. And then elsewhere, you know, they're told that they are to, that they're created male and female, and that they're to be fruitful and multiply. So God is the one who institutes the nuclear family. That is God's way. So we're looking at what does it mean to honor your mother. When giving the commandments, God tied the commandment to honor your mother to that of having a long life. Put this one in your notes. It needs to be there. Exodus 20 and verse 12, the first giving of the codifying of the commandments, where it says, honor your father and your mother, that the days, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God gives you. You know, have a long life, stay in the land for a long time. So we see that the concept of honoring our mother is a very serious matter. It's to be pondered by all of us in God's church. Here's one for your notes, brethren. Proverbs chapter 20. For converted brethren, the biblical promise of a long life points to our eternal life. Honor your mother to have eternal life, or the forfeiture thereof. And it says in Proverbs 20, verse 20, whosoever curses his father or mother, his lamp shall be put out in obscure darkness. That's talking about the second death, brethren. We are guilty of cursing a parent when we conclude that they are not worthy of honor because of some past offense. We have to always be working, praying, seeking reconciliation. Men have always justified the breaking of God's commandments. They find a way to do it. When someone reasons that he has an excuse not to honor a parent, he better be very careful that he is not falling into a trap. It's a very serious offense, and it's a salvational matter also. In Matthew 15, let's go there, brother. Matthew chapter 15, I'd like to begin in verse 4. Matthew 15 in verse 4. For God commanded, saying, this is Jesus speaking, for God commanded, saying, honor your father and your mother, and he that curses father or mother, let him die the death. Jesus Christ is quoting that Proverbs 20 and verse 20 that we just saw. But you say, okay, here's someone justifying themselves. I'm not going to honor my parents, and here's why. That's what they're saying. Whosoever shall say to his father or his mother, it's a gift, or by whatsoever, you might as be profited by me. Okay, that's obscure. I'll come back and explain that in just one second. Let's finish this thought. Verse 6, and honors not his father or mother. That's the justification in verse 5. And so he ends up not honoring his father and mother. He shall be free. That's what you say. Jesus is saying this to the Pharisees and the scribes. Thus, have you made the commandment of God of none effect by your tradition? Jesus Christ said, you just undid one of the Ten Commandments. You can't do that. We've seen that today. Put this in your notes, brethren. It goes with these verses. It's over in Mark chapter 7 and verse 11. And you'll remember this. It's a familiar verse. Jesus said, this is quoting Jesus, but you say, if a man shall say to his father or his mother, it is Corban, that is to say, a gift, by whatsoever you might be profited by me, he shall be free. Okay, what's going on here, brethren, is this very clear commandment to honor your parents. And when they get old, you take care of your parents in their old age. Just like the parents take care of the baby, they give him life, they bring him into the world, they feed him, change his diaper, send him to school, raise him up, protect him, take care of him, and they do that for, you know, 15, 18 years till he can go out on his own. In the same way, when a parent gets old and can no longer be gainfully employed or work for something, it's the responsibility of the children. But what was going on is the people in Jesus' day were saying, oh, I don't have to take care of them. I gave it to church. I'm involved in the YOU. I'm involved in the track meets, volleyball, basketball, and that takes up all my money. I don't have any left over for my parents. And besides, since what I'm doing is church stuff, that comes before my parents. Jesus says, when you do that church business in front of your parents' need, you're making the commandment of God of none effect. That's what he's saying. He says, when you do that, the social order of a nation unravels, and family ties are broken, and things begin to fall apart. You know, that's why this command from God is a foundation. Honor your parents as a foundation for society itself. And so Jesus explained that it was not permissible to substitute good works in lieu of God's command. Honor of parents must exist from generation to generation to generation in order for godly fundamentals to flourish and to maintain national stability. That's why America is going to fail, because we don't have that national stability anymore. Because without the godly essentials, history clearly shows that nations soon degrade into lawless, uncivilized barbarianism. On the other hand, God's way ensures that your days may be both multiplied, that your days may be multiplied in the days of your children in the land, which the Lord swore unto your fathers to give them, as the days of heaven upon the earth. That means like forever and ever. You know, God's blessings will be there. Brethren, if God's way of life came to us naturally, He would not have had to give us the Ten Commandments, including the commandment to honor your father and honor your mother. You know, animals do possess instincts, and it causes the mother animal to look out for her young and the young to seek the mother. But that's only for a time, till they develop a little bit. They don't stay together to build an extended society for the good of the species. Children, on the other hand, do not have that instinct. Oh, maybe a little bit to suckle or something like that, but not to honor their parents. They must be taught the right values of family. They must be taught the right values of godliness, because those standards, those morals, those ethics do not come naturally. Our kids don't just soak them up for being around us, not to the full extent. Yes, we should teach them when we go out and when we come in, and nail them on the door so that we always remember. God tells us, teach them to your sons in Deuteronomy 4 and verse 9. He says, teach your children in Deuteronomy 11 and verse 19. Brethren, late in 1986, I received a phone call from my mother, and I was in Pasadena, California at the time. She called to tell me that she had decided she was going to have an operation on her carotid arteries, and she wanted to let me know. And she wanted to talk to me, and she was concerned, and she was a little fearful. Mothers need honor. They carry things in their hearts all their lives. Mothers need honor even more when their children are older. My mother called me, and we spoke of how dangerous an operation it was that she was about to go through. It was our last conversation. God requires that mothers should receive honor from each of her children continually throughout the year and throughout life. It does not come naturally. We in God's church must work at it. We give honor to our parents. And when we do, we give honor to and glory to God. And how so? Parents want their children to do well. In the same way that God wants to teach us, His children, the children of God, to do well. Brethren, we cannot honor God and at the same time not honor our parents.